A lifetime of training, practice, study, hard work. Through discipline, some achieve excellence, mastery, fulfillment, self-actualization. What can we learn from their beginnings, discoveries, motivations, and falls? How do they dust themselves off and resume their journey? During these interviews, stories, and conversations, we reveal their intrinsic drive. Robert Cuttarella spent most of his childhood evenings burrowed under his pillows, a transistor radio speaker in his ear, listening to the Dick Clark Show and other famous DJs. A passion for rhythm emerged during drumming sessions with wooden spoons borrowed from his aunt. At 9 years old, Robert's parents took him to see drum icon Gene Krupka at the Metropole Club in Midtown Manhattan. Krupka's physicality and deep passion for his craft made a lasting impression on this soon-to-be music industry giant. Young Robert had visions of owning his own company and following a career in the music industry. Robert developed an ear for rhythm, melody, and song structure. Through growing up in the rhythm and blues era, he earned the opportunity to play with doo-wop greats the Shirelles, Dion and the Belmonts, among others. Robert then took a side road. He fell in love, eventually marrying his childhood sweetheart, became a teacher, owned an antique store, sold clothes on the weekend, and played music at night. Music was pulling him to go all in. He accepted an ultimatum from his wife to make it in the music business within a year. 10 months later, Robert recorded his first album. We learn of Robert's devastating losses, heartbreaks, and betrayals, and priceless wisdom gained. He recalls humble beginnings, meeting clients at his first office at St. Patrick's Cathedral and returning calls in the New York City Public Library's phone booth. During the last 40 years, this music-producing mastermind has produced over 3,000 songs, 160-plus platinum records, including 2 Grammy Awards for the Les Paul and Friends tribute album. Robert discovered and launched careers for some of the most prolific performers of all time, including legendary blues guitarist Stevie Ray Vaughan and pop singing megastar Celine Dion. This behind-the-scenes hit-making genius has guided current recording giants John Legend and Lady Gaga through his songwriting mentorship programs. We are anxiously awaiting Robert's new book, and we hope you glean valuable insight and enjoy meeting this music industry superstar on this episode of Intrinsic Drive. All right, Robert. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your super crazy busy schedule with artists and all that you're doing now with the new book and the new school. And just like to welcome you to Intrinsic Drive. Thanks for coming, man.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
And yeah, let's go to the beginning for you. And, you know, kind of in the show, we have the genesis or the start. Would, for you in music, would it have been that time when you're 9 years old and your parents take you to the Metropolitan Club and you see Gene Krupka? Was that when you saw this amazing drummer with the pompadour hair that wasn't out of place and you said, that's me, I want to do that? Was that the moment?
We always look for the defining moments, right? And yeah. I mean, I know that that was a pivotal moment, but even before that, I used to watch the Dick Clark Show.
Okay.
New York, or he was in Philly, I think.
Okay.
But, you know, it was this, it was television and it was transistor radio, which, you know, that dinosaur, but it's, you know, that was mono. So you only had one ear plug, you put it in your ear. And this jockeys would be talking to you, you know, and basically they were your voice. They were speaking your voice through this, through their music and through their commentary, you know. And it was a lot of fun because my parents would say, Robert, I can hear, go to sleep, you know.
And you're under the covers, you got the transistor, you're hooked up.
Transistor radio and 2 pillows. You had that. Yeah. And I never used the 2 pillows for my neck.
It was good for you. Yeah.
Over the head. So, right. So they couldn't hear the music, you know. But yeah. The Metropole, when I went to the Metropole, because it's impressive to sit next to somebody who is that physical,
yeah,
that musical, and is very naturally doing what he does. It's not this effort like, oh my God, I got to lift 450 pounds. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's not that kind of an effort. The effort is he's playing his heart out because there's something deeper in there that's pushing him to do that. And that's what I identified with. I mean, I'm only a kid. I get that. And I was playing sports up to then all the time, you know, baseball, football, you know. And so that was always the drive, was always some kind of physical thing. But watching him, you know, and I was a bit, and that I was chubby and hunched over. And I just took a look at this guy and I went, wow. I mean,
yeah.
I still have the signed album cover, you know.
Wow. Which
is great. And I still have that. Still have the album. And, you know, and it's interesting because then that's a rabbit hole too. You know, it brought me down the rabbit hole of, oh, let me learn about drums. Oh, how do you tune drums? You know, oh, what drums made of and all that. So, yeah, the short answer is that would be one of the most pivotal moments before the Beatles.
And so there's a passion that's coming out and also obviously a curiosity and a joy of this music, and the DJs are talking to you and you're like, okay. And so then you start practicing, right, to the 45s. You had a turntable and you're practicing
in the beginning for me it was just boxes, and my aunt lent me her wooden spoons.
You know, okay.
In between sauce. I get the wooden spoons. So I get a half an hour, 45 minutes here and there, you know, and I can practice to the Beach Boys or whoever. It was mostly at that point, it was stuff like, you know, as we stroll along together. You know, it was always the doo-wop stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And seeing that was beautiful too. In my house, we had a Victrola, as I explained to people. It wasn't. You know, we didn't call it a record player. It was called a Victrola.
Victrola, right.
Yeah, that's what RCA made, the Victrolas.
That's right.
And, you know, later on you find out RCA was part of Channel 4, which is one of the main, they all had TV stations. Sony, Columbia Records was Channel 2, CBS. And so it was pretty cool. You learn all that later. But
Was still some radio shows when you were growing up.
Oh, yeah.
There was
still
the old time radio. There was still some of that going on.
There was that going on in TV. We had a TV upstairs and downstairs in my house where my aunt lived and parents. And my father loved music. My father was a singer who couldn't sing in time.
Okay.
And having a drummer for a son, you know, you can get a lot of arguments about
it. There you go.
This is where the time is at, and this is where you're supposed to phrase this. Mm-hmm. But you know, he just sang because he loved it. And my mom loved listening to music too, but she loved Mahalia Jackson and Della Reese. And odd stuff for a white kid, you know, growing up, you know, partially in Brooklyn and Queens, you know. So, but the love affair of hearing it all the time and the joy in it. And the pain in it too. Like, it's weird, you know, there's a lot of joy in it in music all the time, but there's also a lot of pain in it.
That's right.
For some reason as a kid, I don't know why I identified with the pain too. You know, I mean, to this day, I still feel artists, you know. As a matter of fact, I'm always looking for that visceral response somehow.
Makes sense.
You know.
Yeah, and that helps you to step into the space with them, I'm sure, you know, because of your modulating the frequency and you're feeling them in the heart, you know.
Yeah, see, that's interesting, modulating the frequency, because to me it's all energy and it's all reaching different chakras.
Yes.
And I just relay a really crazy story, but to your listener, it might be a cool story.
Yeah, tell me.
When I had cancer,
yeah,
I was having trouble with my bladder, and they didn't want to send me home with this unless they sent me home with a catheter because I was having trouble with the bladder. And I just could not, for whatever the reason, that was the one stumbling block. So they, you know, said, look, you're supposed to be released in 3 hours. So I don't know, you know, if you don't get to go to the bathroom in 3 hours, you're going home with a catheter. And there's no way in the world I was going home with a catheter. So yeah. I called up a friend of mine who had tuning forks. And when you talk about modulated frequencies, he came over. They didn't really want him in there with the forks and all working on me. But he was working on me on my bladder point. And 20 minutes later, man, I was good as gold. Went home without the catheter. And they just looked at me like, how did that even happen? You know, you've been struggling with this for a week now. Yeah. And I said, well, it's not. I said, you know, we can move the energy around. You know, that's sometimes we need a little help.
So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
it just and frequencies. You know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know a lot of people who are working with different frequencies for sleep apnea, for or, you know, things like that, and they're having a lot of success with it. They're having success with Alzheimer's patients.
That's great to hear. You know, I'm sure you're connected to a lot of them through the music world. I know from the healing world, you know, some of us that are sort of non-musical, we use a lot of tones in our healing work. And it's just amazing how it can sometimes break through an old pathway, an old pattern of disease model can unlock.
Well, you have to be open. You have to be receptive, you know. And, and a lot of times we resist that because that's not the old model. It's not what we've been taught.
That's
and
right.
So, you know, to most people, that's woo-woo stuff, you know?
That's right. Yeah.
It's pretty normal, but, you know, that's because I enjoy it. And I find it fascinating, and I think that, I respond to it. You know,
yes.
People don't.
So. Yeah, and the results make sense. I mean, as we look, Robert, in the ascent, like when you're kind of rising, when was it when you felt you were rising in your craft? And how old were you? Was it maybe the moment when you were asked to get on stage with the Shirelles and sort of more into that doo-wop that your father was bringing you into at that time?
No, not really. It's, you know, it's a funny thing because I took a side path, you know. I really, you know, I fell in love with my childhood sweetheart.
Oh, wow.
We were both English teachers and, you know, we both loved music. Her father was a flamenco guitarist, but her father was forced to quit because he was given an ultimatum, either your family by his wife or nothing, you know. I didn't want to be that guy either.
Right.
You know what I mean? Who had to have an ultimatum given, but eventually that's what happened with me. But, the love affair for the music and the ascent, I always felt like I was doing the right thing playing music. Like there was never anything wrong playing music, you know.
Right.
It was just that it was drummed into my head that, hey, you're not a rock star. You're not going to, you know, and these kids are, it's a fad or it's this or that. I never felt like it was a fad either, but, you know, I did what my parents expected me to do. And I went and had a career as I studied to be an English teacher. And my grades weren't good enough. My high school was a nightmare for me because my parents sent me to Bed-Stuy in the middle of all the riots to go to school.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So I got picked up. 8 times, 9 times.
Oh, boy.
My clothes, my homework, my this and that. Oh. And then I was terrified to get on a train. So
of course,
I was not a very good student because I was so traumatized. I wasn't thinking about school.
Yeah.
I was thinking about music.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're getting abused.
I had an escape finally. Yeah. You know, so the ascent really came. There was a knowledge that I was really enjoying what I did playing. It was frustrating not making enough money, but I was almost making the same amount of money as a teacher playing drums on the weekends or playing with different people.
Okay.
And when I started getting more immersed in that world, I wanted to know more, you know. My ex-wife and I came up with, you know, let's give me a year and let's see what I do in a year.
There you go. Yeah.
You know, had a year window. You know, most people take 10 years to get into the music industry.
That's tough.
I got 1 year. So I got one.
Right.
Ten, right?
So you're on the chopping block here.
Oh, I certainly am on the chopping block. Anyway, the long and the short of it is within a year, managed to get a single out, managed to get it charted here and there, managed to manage a band, learn about production. And feel like I'm in the music industry, you know, in less than a year. Like
in less than a year.
Time, yeah.
It's remarkable.
And, you know, on the job training, really, because We didn't have the internet, and we didn't have books that told us all about all this stuff. We had, we had people, and we had to develop people skills.
Yes.
And so thanks to my mom, I was able to get an office in Manhattan. It was right under Stevie Wonder's office.
Oh, wow.
And
that's amazing.
57th and Broadway. Oh, yeah. It was, I mean, because he was there once in a while, you know, he was a West Coast guy, but he was there.
But he was there.
This was in New York. So,
yeah.
And, you know, I started to feel like I was part of the industry in around 1974, 75.
Okay.
I was doing the right thing then. But then,
got it. You know,
I had, like a lot of people, I had a lot of ups and downs, which I talk about in my book a lot. It's just part of life. It's
yes.
not. It's not, oh, it's the music industry. It's not segregated that way. It's not onto just entertainment, or it's just part of life. You go through
that's right
ups and downs. And I don't say that I'm the most graceful by any means in dealing with it, but if you can find a moment of grace in whatever you're doing and realize that, you know, if you're joyful in what you do and that's what's bringing you your happiness, then you're on the right path, you know? So for me, it was the joy. I mean, there's nights when I would play where we would sing certain songs where I would be crying while I'm singing it because it helped. It really hit me that hard. And then there were other nights where I just have a smile from ear to ear.
Yeah.
You know, and there were more of those, although I'm one of these characters that I would be offered a job in the music industry, you know, as an A&R guy. And then literally the day that I go to sign the contract, the guy dies or the guy moved away from the company. It happened 3 times for me.
Really?
I was down to pennies and I was living in, you know, down the village. But I had my office was St. Patrick's Cathedral. I used to use as my office.
Really? That's amazing.
St. Patrick's Cathedral. And then the public library was my phone. And that was around the corner.
That's great.
And those were my two, you know, those are my go-tos, you know. I had two go-tos there. And it's funny because there was a window right by one of the saints, I don't know, called, what was donated by the Maitland family. Mm. Mike Maitland was the president of MCA Records.
No
and
way.
I swore I would work at MCA at some point.
And you did.
I did. I worked at MCA.
Wow.
So I thought that was interesting. A little.
So that was a real synchronicity. Yeah, was.
But I mean, it was, you know how if you put out in the world that, oh, this has already happened. It's just it hasn't arrived here yet.
Yeah.
But so it's already happened.
Right.
That's what I always felt with the MCA thing. MCA was, for me, was a nightmare of a job because it was, you might get your wish, you know, and, you know, sometimes what you wish for isn't what you think it is. So MCA was very bad, like 4 different presidents in 5 years. It's horrible.
Oh. And
horrible.
Was that when you were head of the New York City division of talent acquisition and producing?
Director of talent acquisition.
Okay. Okay.
But that's, you know, it's later on in your journey.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know if I answered your question in a roundabout way, but
No, you absolutely did.
74, 75.
Yeah.
I started to feel like I was in the industry and I was being accepted by, you know, heads of companies. These were my mentors. They're big producers and I didn't know what any of it was. Didn't know what producing records and didn't know nothing. Absolutely ignorant of all of it.
Wow. So, let's go to some of those in your discovery, like through these experiences and events, like having an office in St. Patrick's and then, you know, phone over there at the library and all these things. Who were some of those other mentors? Like, was it George Martin from the Beatles?
My friend Bob Rose, who was a studio guitarist. I made friends with all the studio guys.
Right.
They were popular then. They were making all the records. Everybody called them for all the records. And somehow we just bonded because we're musicians and all this.
Yeah.
And so we would all hang out together and they would invite me to the sessions they were playing on and I would just sit there. So George Martin was one of them with the Neil Sedaka record, A Song.
Mm-hmm. Matter
of fact, Will Lee was the bass player. We were talking about that the other day.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, we were just connecting a dot. You know,
neat.
About stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so I sat there and I didn't ask many questions initially, but I did observe how powerful somebody like a George Martin is. And then Rupert Holmes, who was also an artist, was producing Barbra Streisand then. And he was very nice to me. Me and a guy named Jeffrey Lesser. Arif Mardin.
Arif
Mardin to me is the quintessential definition of a producer. He's versatile, he's an arranger, kind as can be, his total respect from every musician he's ever been around. You could just, and you know the thing during those time periods, and this kind of played into something too, which I liked. These guys would get dressed up to go in the studio like a job. Uh-huh. And, you know, not that it's important to be dressed up, but it put a bit of a separation in a good way.
Yeah.
You know, so the
makes sense.
Like, they came in, did their job, but here was this guy who actually thought out all the songs, all the arrangements, went through all that, you know, because that's what a producer did then. They had arrangements and everything. They didn't have the tools that we have today where you can just press a button and it's kind of like already arranged for you because
this is an analog.
I mean, this is the real live. Mm-hmm. Arif was a big, big influence on me because he had worked with Chaka Khan, Phil Collins, the Bee Gees. And when I got my first job, the Bee Gees were like first people I met on the job. You know, and we had Saturday Night Fever at that time. So it was big, you know.
Couldn't be bigger.
Yeah, I mean, and my head was like, wow, I'm working here.
Yeah.
Wow. You know.
Right. It's not like work, like you said. It's like, you know, this is it's a passion and the time's just going. And
I was determined. There was no way I was not going to make that job work for me. No way.
That's amazing. And in the drives, so here you are at this dream job. And what else do you feel like? What were some of the external and internal forces and motivations during that time in your life? Like, what was urging you forward, that passion? Because you being a musician and then you're inside all these studios and you're learning and growing. What were some things that come to light?
That became very natural stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I was also... I'm a sensitive person in a weird kind of way when it comes to, I was always insecure about myself and my body and everything else.
Yeah.
And so being divorced, I was thrown into a whole new world around that time frame, being divorced. And it was also a very sexual revolution. And
yeah.
So there were a lot of, you know, what drives you, Robert? Well, she's 5 foot.
Night fever.
Definitely night fever. It became day fever before I had the job. Day fever, night fever, morning fever. I mean, unfortunately or fortunately, I was such a dog, you know, that way. It was
That's amazing.
No, but you know what it was? It was everything was part of a discovery. It was all related. It wasn't, you know, it was finding a way. I couldn't find a balance. I didn't have a balance. Mm. Right? So I would overdo everything. You know, overboard, which is why I don't do drugs or drink or anything stuff, you know. I'm really, if I overdo anything or have, it's been health related. But, you know, I was driven to be a part of an industry, contribute, and understand what it feels like when you, like the first platinum record I got, man, my head was spinning. And then there was this wild thing, and it came about in the strangest ways, too, because my boss was a man named Irwin Schuster. There was Irwin Schuster, Irwin Robinson, Frank Militari, and Don Oriolo. It was four different guys who I got my job in a very, very odd way because three opportunities came the same day. I went to the interviews with all of them, and this was 1978.
So this is Chapel Polygram, right? This is now that.
Chapel Music.
Yep.
But I was offered a job with Columbia Records Publishing, which is called April Blackwood.
Mm-hmm.
I was offered a job with Billy Joel's ex-wife, Elizabeth. So, and that was at the height of his, you know, stranger and all that stuff.
Right.
So But I didn't feel those jobs. The odd one for me was chapel, because I had known the people up there. I'd liked the people there. They knew me with, you know, to always take
the tour. Yeah.
So it felt good up there, but they were in the middle of doing construction. I had my one nicest pair of shoes on, you know, I was struggling, you know, so I wasn't in flush means by anything, you know, and I always try to keep myself looking good, and, you know. So I went up there, and my boss says to me, my boss to be, said to me, you know what? He said, this is a strange meeting for me. I said, why is that? He said, I just hired somebody this morning, but they told me I had to see you. So I said, okay. So I said, so there's not much of a shot here, is there?
Right. Yeah. You know? It's a foregone conclusion. Yeah.
But it wasn't, because he gave me what's called the Clive Davis litmus test. what he did was he would play a song and he'd say, who do you think should record that song?
Uh-huh.
And I answered five of them, and all five had just been recorded by the people I said.
Oh,
so
you had that ear. Yeah.
He threw the cassette at me and he said, what am I supposed to do now?
Yeah. Here's my guy. Here's my real guy right here. Yeah.
Oh, I don't, what can I tell you? You know, I said, I don't know. I said, I would love to be here. The salary was about $5,000 less than I was making playing drums.
Oh, really?
I was playing drums for a mafia guy.
Oh.
And I was making good money because it was all cash.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, over there, if you play Mama twice a night, you know, the guy's, hey, Frankie, give him 100. Oh, come on. It's 1970. There's 100 here. There's another meal. Hey, come here. Hey, when they put their arms around you, right. The guy, vice grip, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was making good money, but I couldn't wait to get out of there.
Right.
I really couldn't wait to get out. I was watching after this guy's girlfriend, even though he was married. Part of the deal with us was, I got the gig, I had to teach her the music industry. So it was I wanted out, you know, as quickly as I could get out, I wanted
out. A lot of baggage that came with that. Yeah.
Yeah, it was too much. And there were, at that time there were mentors who were helping me there too, like Neil Bogart, who, you know, had Donna Summer and all that stuff.
Right.
You know, these were people that were in my corner, but anyway, got the job because when I went home, I ripped the last pair of shoes that I had, the nice shoes. Now I'm thinking, I don't have the job. I got to work for one of the other assholes because they felt like they were assholes. You know, I shouldn't say that, but I didn't feel comfortable with them.
Makes sense.
Got on the train and I'm cursing like an old drunken sailor, right? Shoes, you know. And then I get home and on my machine it said, you know, what do you want for lunch tomorrow?
All right. All right. But, from the new office, yeah.
But this may answer a question you may ask or not, but I think it will.
Mm-hmm.
I went to work then. I would go in at 8 in the morning. Everybody else comes in at 10. I would go in at 8. I would study the catalog.
Yes.
This and that. I would also drink a pot of coffee before anybody came in, so I was like a screaming Mimi.
You were rev, man.
Oh, I was more than rev, trust me.
High octane.
I was like, hello. It's like, what is it, the Roadrunner?
Yeah, that's amazing.
But I would go in at 8, and I would leave some nights at 10 and go see 3 bands and then come in at 8 the next day again, you know. And I think the exercise and everything really helped me because I was amped up, but I was also, I could exhaust myself to go to sleep 5 hours and be happy as I am coming in the next day.
So you were running in the park and doing some, so you were,
during the day,
taking
my
care
lunch,
of yourself.
Yeah, yeah, my lunch was at the health club.
Nice. Fantastic.
Running in the park.
Yeah.
It helped, but I tell you what, I did burn out. They put me in the doctor's office one day. I passed out. They brought me to the doctor's office.
Okay.
And they said, look, you're burnt out, pal. You know, you got to cut out the nighttime thing. You know, you can't go out to 1 in the morning every morning and work, you know. So I stopped, you know, for a couple of weeks. I laid low, according to my boss. They said, lay low. And what was happening was I was pitching 40, 50 songs a day to different people, and I was getting no results.
Okay, yeah.
And I was learning all the producers, and Clive Davis and I were becoming, you know, like I was on his speed dial because he liked my taste in songs.
Right.
But nothing yet. So one day my boss says, get out of the office. I said, oh, did I get fired? He said, no. He says, I'm so happy I have you here. Just get out of the office for the afternoon. Take a walk. Mm-hmm. Go to the park. I said, well, he said, go to the park. I'm telling you, get out of here.
Yeah.
So I grabbed the cassette with me. I wasn't going to leave without a cassette.
Right.
Got a cassette, and I walked right into Clive Davis.
No way.
Clive, I got a song for Barry Manilow, and Barry was with him. I said, I got a song for him. And then I got another song. We've got a new group called Air Supply.
Yeah.
Anyway, I give him three songs, and I get a call that afternoon when I come back. Said, we're going to cut all of them. One's going to be the second single, and the other one's going to be Barry's single. And it's going to bring his career back, but we need a piece of publishing. So I talked to my boss. My boss negotiated it. So all of a sudden, I'm finally getting something. And the same week, I got a call about Chaka Khan song. That became a gold record. But they offered me a job in the West Coast. And so they said, I'm going to send you out there for 3 weeks. And if you like it. And I said, well, sure, why not? I went out here to meet people and all. And what happened was when I got in the car going to the airport, both of my songs were playing back to back in the radio.
No way.
And I was smiling like you would not believe. I get on the plane. I go, wow, I'm doing the right thing. I know I'm doing the right thing.
Yeah.
I land. And as I'm landing, there's fires everywhere and all. I'm going, holy shit, what happened here? Does this earthquake happen? No, that's just like normal West Coast stuff, fires in the mountains. I didn't
really?
Know that that's West Coast stuff, but I'm looking out the window going, this is horrible.
Yeah, this is not good.
Same two songs playing again. And I went, okay.
Okay, this is meant to be. Yeah, this is meant to, yeah.
So there's like a confirmation that,
yes,
you know, I know I've been speaking quickly because I don't know what time frame is here.
No, you're good. You're good. Take your time. This is really amazing to hear this, all these synchronicities coming together to, you know, moving you forward and giving you that validation that, okay, I'm in the right place. You know, I'm in the right industry. We're making a difference. Things are landing. What about falls for you? And you may have already said that when, you know, your shoe ripped and you're on the train and you're, you know, cursing, but
that was just like, you know, that was a blip.
Okay, very good. I thought so, but I, you know.
No, but I did have a fall coming.
Okay.
A big fall coming, which was totally unexpected. When my parents, they got divorced and they got back together. My father was having affairs, an affair with my mom's sister. I mean, just the family was wackadoodle. I'm an only child.
Yeah.
I'm in the middle of all this and I'm still... I was trying to be, you know, stay married. That didn't work. Then I've got this job and I'm trying to get my head about that. And also, when you're getting a lot of people give you accolades and you've never had any of that positive reinforcement, you know, then you got to deal with that. I was going to therapy, so that was good.
That's good.
The therapist that I had was a really good guy.
Great.
And it's another Italian guy, but he taught me to meditate and all this stuff.
That's great.
Like all these Italian. My roommate was DeVito. The other roommate was Russo. The guy's name is Santa Maria. I'm like, you know, all you're missing is meatballs and a pinky ring, you know? So,
you're making an offer you can't refuse, kid.
Yeah.
Sit at the couch.
You can't understand. It's like, but the fall was coming, and the fall was that. Politics internally in big companies. Now, I was extremely, extremely, extremely close to my boss. He was like a father to me. We just would hang. We'd go to he was part of the Friars Club. We'd go there for dinner.
Yeah, the Friars,
Friars Club. You'd see all the Alan King and all these guys sitting around.
You know? I know. I have a friend that belongs there, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, now I don't know what it is now, but I mean, they're trying to re-up it, but during that time, it was a big deal. My friend Frank would take me there all the time because he used to manage Sinatra. So,
neat.
Anyway, so I was very close with this man, and two things happened that were really, really pivotal. One was I get a call one morning saying, from my mom, saying, your father has a couple of months to live. And I'm like, excuse me? And I don't know. I just broke down. I went freaked out. He says, yeah, he's only got a couple of months to live. They got 27 lesions in his back. So that kind of freaked me out.
Yeah.
At the same time, two other things happened. I mean, there was a positive attached to this because I got into discovery about diets and stuff because I went to see Michio Kushida, a friend of mine told me.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
East-West Institute.
Yeah, one of the fathers of macrobiotics, Michio. Yeah.
He was the guy. So
yeah,
I got there a little too late for my dad. And it's interesting because 6 months before this, my father was in the hospital.
Yeah.
They told him he had an in-ear infection. It's the first time he was ever in the hospital. And it was an Asian practitioner who said to him, listen, I know you have an in-ear infection. I can give you Dramamine. You'll be fine. It'll go away at some point. But you're going to experience the same thing happening again. Your kidneys and your liver are jammed. And my father was like, well, thank you. Thank you for telling me that. You know, he didn't care. He was like, really? Just get me out of here. Mm-hmm. You know, and he didn't believe him and didn't understand any of that.
Yeah.
Because he was really talking about the kidney points and the liver.
Right. Yeah.
But they did discover my father's cancer. He had 27 lesions in his kidneys, liver, spine. You know.
Yeah.
So right there, here I got this job that's, I got four assistants that I'm working with. It's a powerful job.
Really high powered, yeah.
At that point, yeah, I had a lot of writers, and I was really at the top of where I could go in that setting.
Mm-hmm.
Same time, my boss had this kid, and he said, you know, he's got a good ear, and we need another guy here. Will you train him? So I said, sure, I'm his mentor. And I liked him. He was a very nice person. At least I thought he was a nice person, you know, at that point. We'd hang out. And then I would drive home to Long Island. I'd drop him off. He was out in the island. I'd go see my father and spend the night. And the next morning, pick him up. And it was quite draining because my dad required, you know, I'd be awake half of the night with him sometime.
Yeah.
It just required a lot.
Yeah.
I had to paint this house because that's the last request he wanted. And here I got this job and he's on more morphine and I got to paint the freaking house.
Yeah.
It's this one. But, you know, it was a test, you know, it tested me on a lot of levels because I remember I got my wisdom teeth taken out and I did it all in one night. And I had to talk with the therapist before that. And he said, look, train yourself to know that it's just an inconvenience. You're not in pain.
Yeah.
Just discomfort. And I was able to do that to keep myself going with my dad without taking pills because I had to drive and all. So it taught me a lot of this grit, you know, that you
That's
have inside you don't know you have.
That's
you're
right.
Reaching into something else.
Yep.
But
that adversity. That adversity advantage, you know, you had to go through those. So you had to step through that threshold.
Yeah. And it's not anybody, they don't teach you that. It is what it is. You know, it happens and you have to either can step up or not in
That's
that
right.
situation. But what happened was this kid was, I was teaching this kid, and I had said to him, since I was technically, you know, his boss in a way, you know, I said, look, all the music that comes in, he comes in on a Wednesday from International, and then Friday mornings we get it. I get first shot at sending it out to my contacts, and then everybody else sends theirs out. It's kind of the chain. That's the way it works.
The way it works, yeah.
And it also worked because for 5 years I had been working here, or 4 years, and I had gained that seniority, and that's allowing me to keep succeeding and whatever. Behind my back, this kid was using my name, my contacts, sticking his name on it, and all this stuff. It was all blown up. Same time, my father's dying. Same time, I mean, this was like the perfect storm coming.
Yeah.
At same time, my boss was going through something that none of us understood or knew. He was, all of a sudden, he was drinking at lunch. I think he was taking some kind of pills. His mother had died. He had this beautiful family and really well known, and everybody loved him and just sweetheart. And, you know, I bought him a dartboard one day, and I went to open his door, and a dart came flying out at him. You know, all of a sudden, we're like, okay, no dartboard for him. We got to get him, you know, weights or something else.
Yeah, to,
you
know, something a little less hazardous.
Very hazardous. That thing came flying past my ear. Whoa. I was like, normally, I would just go knock on the door, open the door, and in. You know, but you couldn't do that anymore. So what ended up happening was one day I'd had enough of this when I noticed that my songs that I was pitching, I wasn't getting the credit for. Kid was taking the credit for all of that. I was introducing him to all these artists, Pat Benatar, Cyndi Lauper, all my friends. And what he was doing was he was having sex with a couple of other women in there, and they were helping him out at night and getting all the stuff so ready for him so he could prep and send everything out before it did anything with me. Yeah. I grabbed him one day, and I'm the easygoing guy. I don't fight.
Yeah.
I put him against the wall. Yeah. Next thing you know, my boss is like, okay, you move your office there. You go over there. Yeah. I don't need this BS here. We're there one day, and my boss, we get a call that he's missing for 3 days. And next thing you know, we get a call that he just jumped out of a window. So we were heading to his house. He had just jumped out of the window. His wife saw it. There was a note, but we never got the thing on the note. That was devastating.
Yeah.
At the same time, my dad died. So that happened probably within 3 months of each other.
Okay.
And then I was dating an African-American woman, and my mother was very prejudiced, and she wouldn't talk to me when my dad died.
Oh, no.
Even though, because of that. So now we got this going on. Okay. And then they were selling the company.
All at the same time.
So, yeah. So I took a job at a smaller company, but a more prestigious situation. But it was all a bit overwhelming because that particular job, I signed a bunch of major acts and ended up in a lawsuit because I didn't have a great contract. So I had this perfect storm. Parents aren't talking to me. Then I get the girl, caught her in bed with somebody, even though we never had any disagreements. Everything seemed to be fine. We were with each other all the time. So it was this, I got hit like bam, 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 you know.
Yeah.
You go from this big job to the smaller company. Then you go for you lose your father. You lose the two men in my life that.
Yes.
My father and then my boss. And those were the only two men in my life who, you know, had any kind of impact on me other than the therapist.
Yeah.
And the period following that for about 2-3 years was miserable. I mean, because getting into the lawsuit, I had just signed and involved with Metallica and a whole bunch of people like this. And I lost. Oh,
so that's CBS, Sony, right? With the John Hammond project.
Because John was a sweetheart. But the real boss was this guy, Chuck Gregory. John was getting a little senile, and he wasn't really happy with the whatever they had structured. I don't know what had structured. Stevie Ray Vaughan's tape came in one day, and it was thrown in the garbage by John.
What? What? Yeah,
it'll never end up in a book. So it ended up that through Chuck Gregory's friend, a guy named Chesley Milligan.
Okay.
Stevie Ray came in, the tape came in, and my boss played it for me because I was the head of A&R. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, that's, you know.
Yeah, that's a wrap.
You don't have to think about this one.
Right.
I mean, this is a natural. We just do this.
Yeah.
This deal's done.
Yeah.
So when we played it for John, John goes, well, he's just another blues guitarist. I don't know what we do with him.
Oh.
I mean, it was just John. John could be like that. You know, John was brilliant, but he, like everybody else, just
missed
so
it.
So Chuck and I went to lunch. Chuck, in his infinite wisdom, said, we're going to start a bar band series. So I found out that Stevie's brother was available to T-Birds.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, okay, I called my friend who had just dropped him from Chrysalis, and he told me why and all this stuff. And I said, okay. I said, well, we can get the brother. I said, and then we can get Stevie. And
yeah.
And Chuck said, we'll get Doug Somm. We'll get some other.
Yeah.
Anyway, long and the short of it is we go back in and Chuck could sell ice to Eskimos. And he goes, we're going to do this Bob Hand series, John. It's an amazing. When we got this, you know, the fabulous T-Birds, and we got this guy, Stevie Ray Vaughan, and we got it. And John goes, that's fantastic, fantastic. Do it. Sounds great. Chuck grabs the tape out of the garbage, makes a phone call. And the next thing, we have Stevie and the T-Birds.
Wow.
And I was involved initially as the A&R guy, and then it went to, they did a buyout where John took them over to Sony. So Stevie ended up on Epic.
On Epic.
T-Birds ended up on Associated Labels. I think that's the way it ended up, or vice versa.
Okay.
I was supposed to have points on all this stuff. So I started a lawsuit when everything, I had just signed Metallica, Anthrax, through one deal with this guy, Johnny Z.
Okay.
And I was supposed to have my percentage points on all this. Basha, Gino Vannelli, Vanessa Williams. It was we had a label that should have been the next Chrysalis, you know, but.
Yes. I mean, Patrick Simmons too. I think you.
Oh, Patrick. Yeah. I still talk to Patrick.
Do you? Oh, that's neat.
Yeah. I mean, I try to stay friendly. Steve, Jimmy Vaughan got pissed off because he always wanted me to be his guy. You
okay.
know?
Yeah.
And I, Jimmy, to all his credit, he's not Stevie. He wasn't
no.
Stevie. So I tried to make, you know, the everything happen the right way for them, which we did. The Tough Enough album broke them. But it didn't come out on our label. It came out on through the Sony affiliate. And
that was a very popular. There was two or three cuts on that where they were very top. You know, they were topping the charts, weren't they? I mean,
yeah. Wrap It Up.
Yeah,
became a big one.
Yep.
But the big one was Tough Enough. You know,
mm-hmm, right.
We used to get in arguments about all this stuff too, because mm-hmm. the guys in the band had. I'll just leave it at. They thought about other things rather than just the music.
Got it. Yeah.
And. They think they look at me like I'm the procurer of the other things, you know.
Right. Of the extracurricular activities.
And I'm like, sorry, guys. I'm here to make a record, you know.
Right. Yeah. It's a professional thing.
I'm your label guy.
Right.
But I'm not a bank. I'm not a, you know.
Yeah.
So, anyway, the long and the short of it is I ended up in a 9-year lawsuit with all the labels that the artist ended up on. And I lost. And so that was the final defeat of that. And so I started another company, which is, I don't know what's listed in the bio. I never look at my bio, but.
Yeah, I think I think that your company was the Zaman hit list, wasn't
yeah.
it? Yeah.
So we created 5 number ones out of my living room.
Yeah. I mean, it was a huge success on
I would think so. We started Celine Dion's career.
Yeah. You know, so I mean, unbelievable success.
There's another one that will never end up in a book because the head of A&R died, Don Grierson, who was a friend. And the producer involved, Chris, is alive in London. He's a dear friend. But that was one of those situations that Sony owned the artist through Canada. So that meant you'd have to put her out on a Sony affiliate in the States. So we went to Sony proper, Columbia Records, International, and we met with, I won't mention names because that would insult the guy.
Because
he's another nice guy. But he took the meeting with us and he said, average singer, average song.
What?
And he said, but you own her. You've got a David Foster and Chris Neal produced album. Why wouldn't you put it out? She's only 17 years old. I mean, she's, you know, she's a major potential artist and you already have it here. What does it take for you but promotion? Now we don't believe in it. I said, can we bring it to Epic? We got in the elevator and we went to Epic Records, which I don't know how many floors apart it was. We saw Don Grierson. He said, I think it's a hit record. I think she's great. Blah, blah, blah. Put it out. And a friend of mine helped promotion quietly, and we had a number one record with her, and you know, that started her career. And then I had 2 others with her.
Yes,
but again, I'm a creature of habit, and habits sometimes are not good. I'll say this as a positive thing: just because things are familiar doesn't mean they're good for you.
Wow. Okay,
and I've chosen business partners and people around me in my career because that record company loss was a major loss for me financially.
Yes. Yes.
And then now I start this thing out of my living room. And the next thing you know, I go take a vacation and my partner's got a whole floor on 57th Street and a whole bunch of workers. And I'm like, whoa, guys, we just got our first check and can't we just enjoy some of this?
Right.
And then there were drugs and then there was drinking. And I had to take a buyout. And that's when I took a job at MCA. I did not want to have a job at MCA, but I was starting to crack, you know, like I'd worked sleeping on my floor, let this guy stay in my house. This, you know, you're busting your ass because you still love what you do so yeah. much and you believe so much in it that you're not going to fail because you didn't fail before and you don't leave any room for failure. You can have blips, like I had a blip there.
Yeah.
But, you know, 3 years you climb back and now you should be sitting on top of the world. And instead you're taking the friggin' job and, you know, so not the ideal for me. I sold my piece at a very low price just to get out of it. My lawyer said, just do yourself a favor.
They're just get out of the situation. Yeah.
Yeah. And they embezzled from me probably millions of dollars because we had brought Leonard Skinner back, you know?
So yes. All of I a sudden, saw that.
Yeah. The money from the management. I'm not understanding why. I'm, you know, so it was a confusing time. And NCA was just one absolute cluster of a horrible. I had more success there and I met some great people there. But that's one that, you know, when that was finished, that was it. I wasn't going for any more jobs.
Okay. Yeah. So you finally realized, okay, no more of this. And I've got to just really reevaluate. And maybe that you were seeing people in their true selves, what they could have been, but what they weren't ready to be in that moment.
Yeah. I always gave everybody the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
And then I made myself such a nervous wreck, I developed Epstein's Barr.
Oh, so, yeah.
I developed a nice immune disorder. It got me into a macrobiotic diet and losing weight again and all that.
That part's good. That's a good pivot. Yeah.
See, and that's the pivot.
Yeah.
Pivot
yes.
Is, again, it's just life happening.
Yes.
The way life happens. And then all of a sudden you're
yeah.
You're just, so, just yeah. your journey. I mean,
that's right.
When you start thinking about it, you know, it's not all this extraneous, oh, he didn't like this one or I didn't like that.
Right.
Wrong, good. That's all extraneous bullshit in
right.
the end. It's yeah. it's this journey that you're on that, okay, did you discover that you finally figured this out that maybe familiar people that you know, well, my father was an alcoholic. So, of course, I'm picking people who have alcohol problems,
yes.
drug problems. And even though they're nice, my father was nice. I love my father.
Yeah.
To this day,
yeah.
I miss him terribly. But it really, when they have these flaws,
yes.
and you feel comfortable enough with these flaws, you're inheriting, you're almost asking for.
Yeah, you're going back to the familiar because that's what you know, even though,
yeah.
okay, it's damage. But that's what I know. That's the motif, you know.
Yeah, you're asking for the punch. You're
so yeah, anyway, yeah.
The left
yeah.
is coming.
Right.
One.
yeah.
And the right too.
yeah. yeah. Right. Right. No, so, I so identify with that. And it feels so good that you know, even if we have to come to the darkest part of the abyss, so be it. Now you're coming out of that. So you're you know, you found the macrobiotics, you found a better way to be healthy. So you're eating differently, you're taking better care of yourself. And now it seems like, okay, what happened career wise after that? I mean, how did you pivot in that way? Like after MCA, what came
well,
up for you?
I had always been teaching songwriting for the Songwriters mm-hmm. Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And that was an evening thing I would do two nights a week because I
okay.
had great classes.
That's great.
And the beauty of that is, I mean, even to this day, I'm still pitching it as a reality TV show because
you should, yeah.
Oh, you don't know how Phil. If you get 20 people in a room, and number one, they're excited to be there. They're different ages, different places in their life,
yeah.
and they start bonding. And it's 10 weeks, and then they sign up again for another 10 weeks and another 10 weeks. And
yeah.
before you know it, you've got them there 3, 4, 5 years. Now I've been best man's at weddings.
I bet.
These are some of my best friends.
Yeah. These are your family. These are your people. This is a creative incubator. You know,
it's a tribe. The beauty of it, you know, is that you're watching people in their natural element, just trying to attain, you know, like who wants to be a songwriter, who wants to be an artist, who's doing it for fun, you know.
Right.
And what would happen is during the course of it, you'd get somebody would come out as gay. Somebody else would have an affair with somebody. It would just be life again.
The life cycle. Yeah.
Pretty much, you know.
Yeah.
And then you'd live through their things with their deaths and their family, their all this good stuff and bad stuff. And you're also watching them blossom as a songwriter. Watching a progression. So in the midst of all of this, you got this great progression going. And for me, that was really exciting and always has been. I did it for 16 years.
That's amazing.
You know, through those programs, Lady Gaga came through there.
Did she?
Wendy Starland, Lana Del Rey, John Legend.
Wow.
All kinds of great people came through the system, you know. So I mean, I started doing those again. I kept doing those. And then I started saying, you know what? I was managing producers. That wasn't working. I managed one guy, got him so much work, he literally dropped dead in his car, in a cab heading to the hospital.
He didn't say he had
a heart problem. We got him all this work. He was taking all the work. And then all of a sudden, he dropped dead in a cab. So that was weird. You know, I mean,
What
are you going to predict that one? I don't think so, you know. I'm going to produce and write.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. And that's kind of the genesis of this new, the mentoring school that's coming up, as well as obviously your book that's coming out that we'll talk about. But
the book started out entirely different. It started out like 20 years ago as one title was Sex, No Drugs, and Rock and Roll. And then that morphed into a different kind of book, and then it became You Couldn't Make This Shit Up If You Wanted To.
I like that one.
And then it turned into another Celebrity, and then Celebrity turned into Mentor. It morphed as I realized what the book was really
about.
It really turned out to be about mentoring. I was fascinated with celebrity, but it turned into this whole thing of, wow, you know, being a mentor and people that mentored me.
That makes sense.
Really had an impact. So.
Yeah, that resonates with me for sure. That makes sense with your journey. And I think if we look at a rollback, Robert, what do you think, like, what would you redo or do differently if anything? You had the opportunity.
You know, I always say I have no regrets, but the truth of the matter is I would do things differently.
Yeah.
That's for sure. I wouldn't be as impulsive as I've been when it comes to decision making, you know, and I'm going to jump into this or I'm going to jump into that. I have a tendency to get so excited about an artist or a writer that it's exciting that discovery, you know, so. I want to get in. I want to get in.
Yeah.
I've been taught to get in before other people. Otherwise, someone else will jump on it.
Yeah.
So I might be less impulsive, you know, that's number one. Number two, I think in the beginning and all, when I started having success, I was arrogant, you know, on some level. Or dismissive here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And I could have been a kinder person, you know, not as dismissive. And I always say I don't want to be the smartest one in the room, but from time to time, I think my ego was not in check enough, and I was probably insecure. So the insecurity turned out to be me being, you know, a braggart or identifying myself with these kinds of successes instead of being a successful person, which is entirely different.
That makes sense. Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you can understand entirely that if you remain healthy and you live a good life and you remain respectful and if you remain humble, you know, then you have a much more successful, or I consider that a much more successful life than somebody who says, oh, I got a boat and I got a house and I got the Maserati and I got this.
That's right.
But I went through all that stuff too. You know, whenever I had money, I just pissed it away because it felt like, you know, you got to show people this, you got to show people that.
Right.
Instead, you know, a better way would have been just be who you are in your heart, understand your heart, and then, you know, call yourself on your BS, you know. If
good
you're lying
you.
To yourself, you know, if you can't be honest with yourself, my God, what are you going to do in the world? And how can you be honest with anyone else? So,
yeah. Well, I love that. It reminds me of what we're talking about off air with your relationship with your godson and how, you know, he's calling you on everything. And it's like this very real, natural, you know, mirror. Obviously, you're seeing yourself in him and he sees things and hopefully in a lot of growth. But that makes a lot of sense to me.
Now, you know, it's part of the journey too. You know, I'd like to think, you know, I've hit a certain age where a lot of my friends recently have been dying. My cousin committed suicide. My best friend.
Sorry to hear that.
You know, almost best friend just died. And all of a sudden, you're looking at mortality and fragility.
Yep.
And you're looking at these two things. You go, you know what? Yeah, I want to live to be 105, 110. I don't know if I will or not, but can I be productive? And what am I going to do now? What's important? You know, of course, one part of me always loves philanthropy and all that, but I don't have the means financially to be philanthropic, but I do have the means to do some good things with people and for people, and that could be helpful. Matter of fact, I went to a fundraiser about a month and a half ago, just invited through some people I'm dealing with, and it was fascinating because they were talking about, I think it was Cambodia, they've been able to build villages, $5,000 a house with fresh
water,
all of this, you know, electricity, everything. And they've been building like 30, 40 of these things, you know. And
even
that night alone, they raised a couple of $1 million that evening.
Yeah. Doing God's work. Yeah, that's but you're sharing your experience and through the mentoring. That's to me that's the ultimate philanthropy is to, you know, give of the self all these rich experiences that you've had and all this knowledge. You really love to pass that on and in the right format, which you're creating now, you know, that's an extension of that other school that you had. And, you know, I think it's really great.
I appreciate it. I mean, I think that I'm a sponge when it comes to the industry and songwriting.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to know more and more and more and more.
Yeah.
And other than having a taser in my hand to get somebody's attention, hey, you, give him some coffee.
Right.
You know, give him a taser.
Right.
No, I mean, for me, I think it's so important that they want to know this stuff. And
right,
you get a lot of I get a lot of what's the word? Pushback.
Okay.
No, that's not what they want. They want the quick road to making the record. I said, I don't look.
No.
I understand that. That's available somewhere too.
Yeah, that's, you know, not me. That's not you.
Yeah, I mean, it's like asking, I don't know, Deepak Chopra or somebody, you know, to do yourself a favor. Forget about the chakras. Forget about the this.
Right.
Forget about that.
Is there a pill I can take, Deepak?
Yeah. I need the quick fix here, you know? And it's not a quick fix. I mean, and that's the whole thing about the journey anyway. It's if you can't enjoy the journey, whatever it is, ups, downs, there's a lot of shit in there and there's a lot of great stuff in there. And the great stuff outweighs the BS, you know?
Yeah, so, I believe that too.
I think that that's part of it, you know.
And I think you've touched on a lot of this, but if we look at one thing we do on the show, kind of the anvil, taking us into account an event or decision that forged you, like a defining moment that kind of shaped your destiny. What do you feel that was? Was it hearing those back-to-back hits coming into LA, or what?
No, LA. Then here's the perfect antidote, and I will answer your question, but you should appreciate this because I've been telling you about the journey and everything else.
Absolutely. Since,
right? So you've got a pretty good handle on some of the events. So I won a few Grammys with a gentleman named Phil Quartararo, who's the head of Capitol Records.
And
he gave me the opportunity. I had a situation where I could create a great record. I thought he gave me the opportunity, financed it, and promoted the daylights out of it. And so that was a beautiful thing, right? So
that was the Les Paul record. Was that correct?
Les Paul record, right.
Yeah.
So it took me 10 years, me, my friend Barry, and everybody to convince Les to make a record. And it wasn't until I got Phil in front of him, and he loved Phil.
Yeah.
And then he said, okay, I trust you.
Yeah.
You know, and it's Capitol, and that's where Les built the, you know, his part of his career is Capitol Records. And okay, so a couple of years later, Phil goes out on his own and he starts a company called Filament.
Okay.
So he talks to me and he says, you got to meet my business partner, Jimmy. I meet Jimmy in New York and they're all living out here. And he said, you know, we got a great company. You should come join us. So I come out here every week, back and forth every week. And Phil goes, why the hell? Just join us. And here came up with the package for us. We had Ross Perot's money, I think.
Oh, wow.
We were supposed to buy Chrysalis Records. We did the due diligence. I was starting to get to, we had 13 extremely highly trained guys that were handpicked by Phil over the years. And Phil knows everybody. And his next door neighbor is Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he broke U2. And
yeah, I saw that in the bio there with his new project. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I say, okay, I'm going to come out. So I finally make the decision. I give up this beautiful loft I have in Brooklyn overlooking all of Manhattan. I'm
going, oh, wow. On the Heights. You were in the Heights or somewhere.
Oh,
I'm
just going to miss this song.
Oh, yeah.
I pulled the car, get the car sent out. And I get here, and the day I got here was April Fool's in 2009. The economy had just collapsed.
Oh, yeah. That was,
it was terrible.
Yeah.
EMG had just outbid us on the company we were supposed to buy, and we lost all our money. So the day I came out here, we had no money, no income, and no job.
The day you came.
I had avoided coming here all my life. I just decided to stay since I've been here after that.
Wow.
Making that major move and everything else.
Right.
Like that. So, you know, even on the surface, it looked like it was great. Is this, that? You can tell that, you know, all those events were going to happen. And that's why it's just life happens through all of this stuff. And you just have to kind of figure it out.
Absolutely.
So that, you know, so your answer, you asked me about when was that pivotal time. It was always in me, and it just became unlocked when I got my first job, you know.
Yeah.
But it was always music. It was always
there. Yeah.
I mean, I would have loved to be in films. I've been in a couple of films and on plays and stuff like that. But you know, I'm a ham. I'm used to
that's York. Great. I didn't know you were an actor too. That's amazing.
Well, you wouldn't call what I did acting, but I was in the anyway. Have you noticed there's no billboard and notice anywhere Robin Cotterella up for Emmy nomination? That's not but I still love to do it, and I'm in a reality show coming up. I've been in one out here, The Real Housewives of Orange County, where I was able to be the first iteration of it. I discovered a girl could sing, and I made her a record deal on the show.
That's fantastic. I want to see that.
Yeah, that was. And I got a better one coming up in next year, so that we start filming in October. So
okay, so we'll make sure we drop that in the liner notes at the end. And Robert, in your journey, and I know you've touched on a lot of this, but what's most important to you now, and what does the road ahead look like for you, and what's next?
Now it's about maintaining the joy.
Yeah.
And whatever I do, because the industry has changed so much. that I am not a fan of where the industry's gone. The industry, and they talk about it freely now. They have to. They lost control of the music.
Right.
So it's now become a popularity contest on TikTok. It's mm-hmm. not about right. let me cover the next Elton John. Or
it's not craft.
Yeah. Loss or any of that. No.
Yeah. It's not the musicality.
No. And the icons that we see, young icons, Bruno Mars started like 12 years ago and he's been on a stage since he's two,
right.
or whatever. Beyonce even further back. Mm-hmm. So these aren't kids that just came up. And, like, I love certain people like Doja Cat and people like yeah. that. I do enjoy. I like Post Malone and all. Will they have the same journey, trajectory that – you know, that we see with Elton John, 30
right.
albums.
Longevity, and right.
like that. You know, yeah, Stevie Wonder. I mean, all that.
Yeah.
We don't have that. And so what's important is, that's why I got into the mentoring thing, is still a way to hopefully inspire. I need to inspire. I hope that whatever I can do can inspire some kind of greatness in people, some kind of joy in their soul, so that yeah. they feel like they're connected.
You That's
know,
right.
In a happy place, you know. Mm-hmm. And they'll get enough other knocks. They don't need, you know, the knocks are going to come no matter what.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. How much money you make, the mm-hmm. knocks come. And the money comes and goes. So, so for me, it's that. And, you know, finding a comfortable place for myself within this, where I'm part of the fabric of it.
Yes.
Because I still enjoy and feel like I can offer, you know, like the old Asian, the Japanese, when they become older and they're paid by the government for a while, yeah. you know, you should mentor, you should teach, you should
yes.
show them how to make the Noguchi table, you know, whatever.
Right. Right. yeah.
That's what, you know, that's where I should be.
Yes.
At the same definitely. Time, you know what else? I'm starting to play every day again and write.
Oh,
every
that's
day
great. Again.
I never released my own records, only early on. That's how I started. So starting to get into that head could be a lot of fun, you know, because I know I have some famous friends and this and that, and could be fun to have them show up and play a gig and people would get gassed by that, you know.
It would be that would be great. That would be fun. Totally fun. Yeah.
It should all be joyful. It should yeah. all be expression and yeah. no judgment. And
yeah. And light. Just like dive into the creative. Just be lost yeah. in that orb of creativity, which is where you really thrive, it feels like.
Well, that's home. That's a home.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If, you know, home isn't where I got my sofa or whatever, you know.
Right.
Home, in my right. head, home is probably all the music that's sitting in my house, you know.
Yes.
It's all the art I like. I paint a lot.
Oh, wonderful.
That shows around the world of my stuff. So I started getting back into that as well.
That's you know, great. Just
a little bit of a full circle kind of moment.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Know? And yeah. if just
stay healthy, that's the other thing.
That's really
that is the first and foremost thing that I've yes. learned after having the cancer. Stay healthy.
Yeah.
Otherwise, yeah. nothing else, you get nothing done.
Right. No, I know that was a great talk we had at the beginning before we aired when we caught up yesterday. And you were talking about the show that you are recommending on Netflix called The Blue Zones, I think it was. It was sort of an extension of the Centurions. You know, what are the five elements of health? And yeah. sort of, you know, this idea of, you know, family or community and natural foods, organic foods or close proximity food quality and location and, you know, lack of stress or a lifestyle
joy.
Are you enjoying what you're doing every day? Are you around people that are kindred spirits? All these things.
Yeah, the laughter thing was yeah. a big thing for all of us. I was always smiling.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it was the wine. I don't know. But whatever it was, they were dancing and smiling at 100 yeah. years old, you know. And I'm like sitting there thinking, I remember my aunt at 100. My aunt lived to be 101.
Wow.
And I think one of the funniest things, you know, because it's hard to accept when somebody then starts to lose touch.
Right. Decline, yeah.
And she had her whole family there. at 101. And she had just been starting to lose it, really. And she was sitting there, and her sister says, "Oh, Irene, I'm so happy to see you." And blah, 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 blah. And my aunt just looked straight in the eye of all of them. She said, "I don't know who any of you people are."
Really?
Said, yeah. "But I'm so happy you're here.
That's good.
So nice."
Yeah.
"I can't even thank you enough, you know?"
Yeah.
And they all left and went, "Holy shit, that's going to happen to me if I'm not
there." Right.
Careful.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, you know, that's life, you know?
That's
101,
life.
She lived to 100.
Yeah.
Clear as a bell. God bless.
God bless. Yeah. Returning to that childlike state. So in the slipstream, Robert, we look back at our lives, and any parting gems of advice you'd like to leave for us today?
You know, I can. And I was going to quote from my book, but I don't have it sitting in front of me. But instead of quoting from the book, I'll just do it off the top of my head. First of all, we just talked about staying healthy.
Yes.
The most important thing, developing a sense of yourself and understanding who you are and being honest with yourself and others. Be respectful of others. Don't be the smartest person in the room.
Right.
Never, ever
want to. Don't fall into that trap. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
And, you know, learn that you're in business that I'm in, you're going to meet the same people going up as coming down. So you got to figure that out. You know, you got to figure that if you're not respectful, if you talk shit about people, if you bet, you know, that way, that doesn't work.
No.
That never works, you know. In our business, I think you have to listen, be a good listener,
mm-hmm.
think outside the box, be as creative as possible with the tools that you have, and learn, just constantly learn. Same, you know, I reduced my life to two things, and people laugh at me for this, and I don't care. I really don't care.
Good.
There's only two things in life for me. One is learning to love myself and others around me and bring that love out. So that respect is part of the love, you know, honestly respecting inanimate as much as animate objects. In my case, I believe that it's all connected. It's all
yes.
part of one. So I don't think you can separate, you know. It's like trying to separate one part of your body and saying, well, the heart, you know, one thing, but no, it's all connected.
Yeah.
So learning to love. And then the second thing is learning lessons. So two L's, that's it. Two mm-hmm. L's, pretty simple. Everything else I've learned that I've complicated my own life by all the other things. And otherwise, it's a lot simpler. Life is a lot simpler, you know.
It feels like you're living by those tenets now. You know, when we talked the other day and it was something about driving all around town, you're like, nope, they're going to come to me today. It's going to be not in an arrogant way, but just in a way of, okay, yeah, that
well,
felt right.
You know, you have to get, you have to know where.
Yeah,
it's limitations. It's not a pecking order. It's not, right. it's not a pecking order.
Yeah.
I don't want to be that arrogant. But, you know, once in a while you feel like, okay, this has to be mutual.
Yes.
And that's part of the respect and learning lessons and all that's part of lessons. You know, I'm sure you've experienced this in your life, and I know my friends have.
Yes.
They put out a lot of energy in one direction, you know, and unfortunately we do a lot of times have expectations.
That's right.
Not that that's, you know, maybe expectations should be limited to our own expectations about ourselves and not from externally, because people, it's hard to keep people to that, to our, what we want, you know.
That's right.
Desires. But, you know, it's a give and a take. And if it's mutual, then that's what feels right. And if it's not mutual, you're going to try to find a balance. That's been tricky for me. Balance has been difficult for me.
And being in the moment, I think that's a new practice for you now, is diving into being in the moment. You were saying the other day.
And it takes me, you know, the drawing and the painting.
Yeah, it takes you right there, isn't it? Yeah.
You don't really have an option.
Right. That's right.
And the writing process. And,
right.
I mean, you might not love what you write. You may do a lot of editing. But, you know, being in the moment, you – like, you know, if I was sitting talking to you like I have been for the last whatever. If I was distracted, I wouldn't be able to focus and I wouldn't be in the moment.
Right.
We'd miss a lot of stuff.
No.
The good stuff would go by because we wouldn't, or I wouldn't even be attached to it at that point, right? And so
that's right.
You'd ask me a million questions and I'd be casually answering something that's caca.
Yeah. Well, that didn't happen today, and I'm so grateful for our time together.
No, I truly appreciate it. For me, I love, you know, if there's anything that comes out of it that, you know, resonates with someone and makes them feel good, helps them on their journey, helps them identify things that might be stumbling blocks or things that might be something that they want to do or they have a desire to do, I will do this all day long. You can always call me.
Fantastic. And yeah. Folks, we'll have the links to the book when it comes out, Mentor, and all the new projects. We look forward to that. Robert, thanks again for coming to Intrinsic Drive. You were a pleasure to be with.
Phil, you too. Have a lovely day. And to all your listeners out there, go out and have fun. Enjoy your life.
There's nothing better than fun.
No, there's nothing better. All right. Oh, stay healthy.
Thanks for being with us. We appreciate you opting in, subscribing, and reviewing us, for thumbing us up and following us on socials, liking us. We like you. Drop us a note. Tell us what stories move you. For books, videos, resources, and more information, visit us at whartonhealth.com/shopwhartonhealth. And be sure to join us for the next episode of Intrinsic Drive.